Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what the Valley can maybe learn from an East Coast city about keeping cool in the summer.
And why private equity firms are buying up mobile home parks and what it means for the people who live there.
But first, scientists have long known that trees are helpful in the fight against climate change by taking carbon dioxide out of the air. But new research finds trees are even more beneficial than we realized. Microbes living in their bark can help remove methane from the atmosphere. With me to explain is Alexander Schenken, an assistant research professor at NAU and director of the Ecosystem Science and Innovation Lab, where he does research on forests. And Alexander, were you surprised by what you found with this research?
Yeah, it was. So my colleague Vince Gauci from Birmingham discovered the process itself, and when he told me about his discovery, it was quite surprising. Having said that, there are bacteria all over the place, and so you know they do all sorts of crazy things. I guess the real surprise was when we scaled this up across forests around the world, that it turns out to be a really important process in the global carbon cycle. That was the real kicker, I think, when we all kind of said, oh, wow, this is really something here.
So how exactly does this work? How does tree bark play a role here?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it turns out that tree bark and what we call sapwood, or the living wood underneath the bark, plays host to bacteria of all types. And one of those types are called methanotrophs. They are bacteria that eat methane instead of oxygen for energy. And they exist there in very low amounts, especially because methane is really diffuse in our atmosphere. There's just not much of it. And so it doesn't support a large population, but it supports enough apparently to support the life of methanotrophs in tree bark and in the sapwood of these trees so they consume methane to live.
How big of a dent do you think this could put into our efforts to, you know, reduce the amount of methane in the atmosphere?
Right now, we figure that this is an additional 10% benefit, say, of trees to the cooling of our climate. Having said that, it's not a new process. It's just a new process to humans.
Right.
Right. So we just discovered it. I think the major impact that it could have, however, is by catalyzing more reforestation and forest conservation. If we are able to recognize this additional benefit that forests and trees are providing in the carbon market. So carbon market is not familiar to everyone, but the basic idea is that if you grow a forest, say in Brazil, that wouldn't have been there otherwise, and that is sucking up carbon, then you can trade those credits to Microsoft, say, who is looking to lower their overall emissions. So essentially, Microsoft pays to reforest so that a forest in Brazil sucks up the carbon that it's spitting out in its, cloud computing factory, say.
Do you think that this knowledge will help move along some of those efforts? Because as you point out, you know, this has been going on for as long as trees have been there, whether or not we as humans have known that it's going on. So do you think that by saying, okay, this is even more beneficial, trees are even more beneficial to the environment than we thought, that maybe helps some of these projects get off the ground?
I think so. So we actually launched a spin-off company called SelvaFlux, and we've done some initial models, economic models on it. And, you know, if we integrate these carbon credits into tropical reforestation projects, the benefit to the carbon credits should be around 30% more than what they get with just considering the kind of CO2 that these seedlings are taking up. And if we are able to turn those into carbon credits, Then yes, it will incentivize these companies, these forest project developers, to do on average around 50% more projects.
Does it seem to matter what type of tree you're looking at when you're talking about, you know, taking methane out of the atmosphere?
Oh, that's such a great question. And, you know, this is one of the questions we get, like one of the first questions that everyone asks us is, what about different tree species? You know, and, yeah. And yeah, it's a fascinating question. What controls, how much, because they vary a lot, you know, by a factor of five or more. One tree will be taken up a little bit and another tree will be taken up five times as much. We don't know. So this is an open research question. What is it that controls, you know, so number one, which species take up more or less? And then number two, why?
Yeah, well, it seems like it would really matter in terms of, as you say, where these projects might be more beneficial than others. For example, you know, trees that grow in the Amazon rainforest, I would imagine, are very different than the trees that, you know, might grow in the forests of, you know, central or northern Arizona, where, you know, you can have fires or other, you know, deforestation efforts in both. So it would really matter, like, where these projects might work, right?
That's exactly right. It matters a lot. The species question is still up in the air, but the kind of spatial variation is one that we've gotten a little bit of clarity on. So it turns out that trees in the tropics do this a lot faster than they do up, say, here in Arizona. The best correlation we get is with mean annual temperature. So wherever it's kind of hotter throughout the year versus wherever it's you know, not so hot throughout the year. Of course, Phoenix, plenty hot throughout the year, but that's also dry. So it may have to do with not just mean annual temperature, but also the humidity that kind of supports the growth of these bacteria in this bark. So you think of a urban tree in Phoenix or, you know, a creosote bush somewhere around there, that you know, they are very conservative with water for obvious reasons. And, you know, it's probably not a great environment for bacteria in the bark there versus a tree in the Amazon.
Is it possible, do you think, to simulate the effect of the tree bark? And I ask because, for example, you know, there are researchers at ASU who put up these fake trees in different places to, you know, to take the carbon dioxide out of the air. I wonder if it's possible to do that with sort of fake tree bark if you can't actually grow that kind of tree in a place where taking methane out of the atmosphere would be helpful.
What a cool idea. We'll put that on our list. I think one active area of research that my colleague is pursuing is looking at the microbiological communities that give rise to this process and if they can be amended. So can we add, say, nutrients to help these bacteria grow faster and, you know, more numerous and therefore process the methane faster in existing tree bark. The question of, like fake bark or maybe like kind of hanging gardens or something like that, something along those lines would be really neat. I think, you know, these little critters need nutrients, right? So it's not going to work on like a piece of plastic. But if we can come up with that's a cool idea. I'm sure there'll be all sorts of interesting developments that come out of this.
All right. That is Alexander Shankin, an assistant research professor at Northern Arizona University. Alexander, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Reporter Miriam Wasser brings a unique perspective to her work as a climate journalist. She used to be a reporter here in the Valley, where we know a thing or two about heat. These days, Wasser reports on environmental issues for WBUR in Boston, where she's been covering the city's ongoing efforts to be more livable in the summertime. Wasser recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about what Boston might be able to teach us here in Phoenix. Among other things, she says Boston started making heat maps rather than thinking in terms of overall average temperature, they tried to figure out what life was like on the ground in various parts of the city.
It was remarkable when these maps came back. I mean, there were areas of the city that were like 5 to 10 degrees hotter or cooler, depending on tree coverage. So once you really have a good handle on what the problem is and where the problem spots are, you can then go about figuring out how to combat them. So in Boston, you know, we have a lot of trees in the city, but they're not evenly distributed, and it can be hard for urban street trees to survive. So the city's putting a lot of effort into building up the urban canopy and making sure it's distributed equitably around the city. There are pilot projects out there to see about, can we paint the roofs of buildings white?
Yeah. Well, I think this brings up a couple of really interesting things. One being things like, you know, lighter colored rooftops, more trees. These don't really strike me as super expensive solutions. I mean, I know they're not free, but it's not like we're talking about major technology. We're talking about things that seem more oriented towards community investment and buy-in in terms of how our streets are going to look and whether or not people are willing to put in the effort to plant the trees and figure out how to keep them alive in an urban environment. Have you found that that investment and buy-in from the community is as much of a challenge as the cost of these programs?
I have never encountered anyone who says, I don't want street trees. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable that something as simple as trees can make such a huge difference, but it really does.
Yeah. But given the fact that, you know, as we're talking about, these are not super complicated solutions that seem to be able to have a measurable impact, why do you think we're not seeing trees just planted willy-nilly in our respective cities, or like massive roof painting initiatives being undertaken to mitigate this crushing heat right away? What are the obstacles to the broader adoption of these things that we have seen be effective?
Well, I think in general, anything that city government does or anything that any government at any level does often takes a long time, right? There's a lot of studies that need to be done. You want to make sure that you're doing it in a fiscally responsible way. I actually did a story a couple of years ago about street trees in Boston, and a remarkable number of them die. So you can go about and plant 100,000 trees, but if you don't have the personnel in your public works department who can go out and care for them and make sure that they're watered and that they're going to survive, they all die. And that's just a huge waste of money. How do you make sure that you're planting species that can withstand the coming effects of climate change? Because that's an issue too. A lot of plants that are, you know, native to certain areas can't thrive that well in a hotter climate. Certain trees don't do well with a lot of pollution. And so you want to make sure that the money and effort you're putting into a project is going to have the payout that you want.
Yeah. One of the other big questions here is development. Phoenix obviously has an exploding population. And a lot of the people who move here are moving into these big, fancy new apartment buildings, which also brings more and more air conditioning. And the air conditioning obviously is a good immediate term solution when it's unbearably hot and you need to be inside. But can you tell us at all about how more air conditioning, which leads, of course, to more energy usage, can perhaps be counterproductive over the long term?
I think those concerns are completely valid. But people that I talk to will say, as you said, we're not going to not install air conditioning. Yeah. We're not going to not save lives now because we're worried about the impact in the future. But I can't speak to how popular heat pumps are in Arizona, but here in the Northeast, there's a big, big push for heat pumps. And these are gadgets that run on electricity and provide both heating and cooling. And they are much more efficient than fossil fuel heating sources and much more efficient than your traditional AC options too.
Tell me more about these heat pumps. Is this like an individual unit someone would have in their home, or is this something that could be implemented in an entire apartment building?
It could be both.
Okay.
Yeah, so a heat pump is essentially, you've seen heat pumps even if you don't know that you have. There are multiple kinds of heat pumps. One you might have encountered would be a mini split, which are those little like white boxes on the wall that do heating and cooling.
Okay, yes. You control it with like a remote control and the vents open.
Okay. Actually, your refrigerator is a heat pump. So heat pump technology is quite ubiquitous, but using it to do home whole home heating and cooling is something that is picking up a lot of momentum. So yes, if you haven't heard of heat pumps, you probably will hear a lot more about them in the coming years.
Another thing that I have noticed as a recent transplant here is how much hotter it feels at night.
And it's super dangerous too. Here's the thing about nighttime heat. Like I feel like when we talk about heat, we often think about the highest possible temperatures, which happen during the day. But it's actually the nighttime temperatures that are in some ways the most dangerous because nighttime is when your body is supposed to get a break from that heat. It's when it sort of like resets itself.
Yeah.
And when it can't do that, the risks from extreme heat just compound over time. And so like there are studies out there showing that like the longer the heat wave, the more risk you have. And we know that when it doesn't cool down at night, it just makes it more likely that your body is going to be strained from the heat.
Yeah. There's the physical risk that happens in the moment when your body temperature is elevated. But then over the long term, we know that there can be serious health implications to not getting enough sleep.
Yep, that's another part of the hotter temperatures at night for sure. In advance of this conversation, I actually looked up some of these statistics because I was curious, like how much hotter are nights in Boston and Phoenix than they've historically been. Since 1970, on average, summertime nights in Phoenix are 5.8 degrees warmer than they used to be.
Wow.
And in Boston, it's on average 2.2 degrees warmer. So like anyone listening to this who thinks like, oh, back when I was a kid, it didn't get this hot overnight. Like it really didn't. and that just, I think, illuminates like the change in nighttime temperature is more dramatic in a lot of ways than the change in daytime temperature. But the lack of cooling down at night is in some ways the really big risk. And we know that that's a particular risk for people who don't have homes, right? So who are unhoused and live outside.
So it seems like a word that comes up a lot in these conversations is resiliency, which in my mind is sort of an ominous word because it implies that warming is inevitable and we just have to be strong against it. Is there a sense that this is ultimately like a losing battle and we just kind of have to do the best we can? Or is the thought that these mitigation strategies could really keep cities livable long term?
Oh, I think people really believe that these mitigation strategies will keep cities livable long term. One of the things that I think is really cool about a lot of climate solutions is that they're not just doing that one thing. They're not just lowering temperature. They're also just making life better, right? Like trees are great. And we know that they help clean up the air. And there's all sorts of studies out there about how trees can improve mood and they can help academic performance. Like trees apparently can do everything. And so a lot of these climate solutions that we have are also just going to make cities nicer places to live.
Well, Miriam Wasser is a senior reporter with WBUR's climate and environment team. Miriam, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. This was really fun.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what's kept ASU President Michael Crow in Arizona for more than 20 years?
But first, mobile home parks here and around the country are being bought up by private equity firms and wealthy investors. It might seem like an odd investment, but people who live in these parks often own their manufactured homes, but not the land they sit on, and they're not actually very mobile. The 2022 documentary A Decent Home tells the story of many of these mobile homeowners and their fight to stay in their homes when their rents were raised or their land was sold out from under them. Sarah Terry spent 7 years making the film, and it's screening this Friday at Glendale Community College, and she's on the line now to tell us more about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Lauren.
So I want to begin with the lay of the land here. Like, when did investors start buying up mobile home parks? How common is this?
It's become quite common. It began, the very early days of it were actually back in 2015, when the Carlyle Group was one of the first major private equity firms to start buying mobile home parks. They bought a couple in Florida and a couple in California. And all private equity firms everywhere were watching what Carlyle did, and they had pretty spectacular success. And they followed suit, like, all over the United States.
So what would happen then, like, to the people who are living there? Would they hold on to them, raise rents? What was the, how did they make money off of this?
Well, in some cases, I know, as in Phoenix, you've had parks that have been sold to developers and the parks have closed and turned into development. Mm-hmm. But normally a private equity firm holds a park because private equity essentially looks for a place where they think more money can be made. And in mobile home parks, historically, it was a mom and pop business where, you know, a fair rent was charged for the land that the mobile home manufactured housing owner paid to live there. Mm-hmm. And it stayed relatively low, but fairly so, because the homeowner pays for everything, you know, the upkeep of their home, the, you know, repairs. It's not like, you know, renting an apartment. Mm. So what private equity found it could do was come in and raise lot rents, sometimes by as much as 60 and 70%, which, you know, may not sound like much if you're kind of going, oh, it went from $320 to $405. Mm-hmm. But think about if your mortgage was increased by 40%, 60%. That is a huge impact on people, many people on fixed incomes, or many people already working two and three jobs.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is the first rung on the ladder of the American dream. This is where people are first getting a chance to own their own home.
So tell us about some of those people that you focused on in the film. You talked with people who own mobile homes all over the country, but focused on this place in Aurora, Colorado, called Denver Meadows, right?
Yes, Denver Meadows was, there were two parks, one in Iowa and one in Denver Meadows, that were the main storylines, that are the main storylines in the film. There's a couple other parks that are in there as well. But in Aurora, Colorado, at Denver Meadows, the owner decided he was going to try to sell the land. And he did it in a sort of very hidden way. And the residents found out about it. And this community of over 100, mostly Latino, many immigrant, many families, you know, parents working two and three jobs, went, they organized with the help of an organization called 9to5. They went to every city council meeting for something like 3 years, mm-hmm. and fought the attempt to sell the land. It was an attempt to rezone without letting them know about it. It's a heroic battle, because what happened, I won't spoil the ending of the mm-hmm. film, but what happened in Colorado, Colorado went from being one of the worst states in the country for mobile home park protections to being one of the best, which isn't saying a ton because there's still more to go, but everything that's changed in Colorado was because of how these people fought for everything they had.
Yeah. So there has been some legislative action, right, in certain states. There's been some changes here in Arizona as well. But there's also been some federal action, right? The Price Act passed after your film came out, putting $235 million toward the preservation and revitalization of manufactured housing. How has all of this kind of action and just awareness of this issue in local and federal governments made a difference?
I think there's a tide turning. You know, it used to be you could still say the words, you know, call somebody or something trailer trash. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the first stereotype that's starting to break. I think as the affordable housing crisis has gotten worse, people are starting to understand the need for this type of home. It's the largest form of unsubsidized affordable housing in the United States. And I think also people are becoming sharply aware of the impact of the wealth gap and just the sheer greed that has driven so much of this. And as these stories have become more public with, you know, the film, with great local reporting, with a piece like yours, you know, people are stopping and going, wait a minute, what's happening? So they're starting to make some small changes. Sometimes it's zoning protection. Sometimes it's a decision to put land into a community land trust. Mm-hmm. Sometimes park residents are able to buy their parks and own them as a co-op. That's some of the big changes that have happened. The Price Act was an appropriation of money. It's the first time in our history that it's happened,
yeah.
which is a super important thing, because America was founded on the idea that the only people who mattered were people who owned land, white men who owned land. That's in our history. So it's been this long, slow arc of change of going, no, that's actually, we're a lot more than that. Let me ask you. It's interesting.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly, just in the last minute or so here, what else needs to happen from your point of view on this front? Like, I'm sure this isn't settled.
No, it's not settled at all. Probably the biggest barrier yet for anybody anywhere is the idea of rent control on the land or some form of rent protection, because I don't know of any state anywhere that has put in place some kind of protection for people who live in parks. So that's probably the biggest hurdle still to go. But I think there's a momentum and there's an arc of change, and it's sort of a great sign, but also sad to me that like 3 years after the film came out, it was on PBS last year, it's still being screened because the problem is still something that needs to be met.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Sarah Terry, filmmaker. The film is A Decent Home. It's screening at Glendale Community College on Friday. Sarah, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
And now it's time for the next edition of our series, Staying Power.
I spent the last 7 weeks trying to figure out how to never come back to Phoenix. And then the second I get back, I'm just like, oh, man, this place. You know, you just feel it. It, like, grabs you. And you're like, oh, okay, fine.
It all brought me back to Phoenix, whether I liked it or not.
Think about leaving. No.
It felt like the greatest challenge.
Whatever you're running to, we should be building that here.
There's something about this place that, for us, and it's just magical. It's not like any place else.
Here, we're highlighting some of the Arizonans who have stuck it out in the Valley of the Sun and made their mark here in the process. And today, we've got someone I'm willing to bet you've heard of. Arizona State University President Michael Crow, who gave me a mic levels check in what he called pigeon French. Usually I ask people what they had for breakfast, but that beats it.
I had two roll-up taquitas at a Circle K at 44th Street and Camelback.
But taquitos aside, Crow's role in the Valley's development and Arizona's place on the map is undeniable, if sometimes controversial. When he arrived at ASU in 2002, it was known as a party school. In fact, that year it was ranked the nation's number one party school by none other than Playboy magazine. But Crow saw it differently.
I had become convinced that we needed a new kind of American university that could be more democratic, more connected to the people, more innovative, more fast-moving. I was at Columbia. I was deputy provost there. I was a faculty member there. I'd been there for a long time, enjoyed it, was successful. But I just felt like I wasn't going to do anything of the kind of level of significance that I thought that I should try to be a part of.
He could have gone on to become university president at any number of prestigious schools, but he turned them all down.
My wife got upset at me, and she said, "You know, what would be the places that you would go to?" So just write them on a list, and you can't go anywhere to interview except those places.
Because you're just going to turn them down otherwise.
Yeah, and she said it's just horrible. So I wrote down three places:
the University of Washington in Seattle, University of Colorado Boulder, and number one on his list, Arizona State University.
Because Arizona is a place in my professional life that I had come to know of as a place in which it was a big house of argument. Every idea was welcome. Every person was welcome. People didn't care where you came from. People didn't care what religion you were. They didn't even care what political party you were. They didn't care about anything. All they cared about was, you know, what can you do? Can you make something happen? So there was openness here.
The appeal made sense to the self-proclaimed Navy brat and Iowa State University graduate who moved 21 times while he was growing up. He didn't come from the elite, and he didn't want to only educate them. Arizona, he thought, was maybe the only place where he could make his vision of what he calls a new American university come true.
Arizona was the one place that you probably had some chance that you could birth an actual American university, as opposed to a facsimile of a British university or a facsimile of a German university.
So it was the anti-elitism, essentially, that drew you here?
It wasn't just the anti-elitism, but it was the fact that there was no elite base.
But this rethinking, this massive expansion into the community, this new approach to what a university is and should be, has not come without criticism. lots of people will say, you know, the standards aren't high enough, the education's not going to be as good as it should be, too many online students. Then, there, you know, criticism that it's been corporatized, right? Like that it's too much like a business.
Yeah.
What's your response?
Well, first, it's not a business. It's a university that operates as what we call an enterprise. So we use business-like models to help generate revenue to be able to pay our expenses in lieu of taxpayers paying for the expenses. And so there's nothing wrong with that. That's the particular political model that we're operating under. But in terms of the quality of education, you know, those are unfounded criticisms based on ignorant individuals who don't really have any idea what they're talking about. We're producing unbelievable graduates from our online programs, almost 100,000 by this point.
When he first came to the Valley, Crow told me he thought that the city was being born. But of course, this was more than 20 years ago, when the population of the Valley was more than 1 million residents smaller than it is now, and downtown Phoenix was a ghost town after 5 p.m. Let's talk about development, which has been a big part of the story of ASU and of you being here. I mean, the footprint of ASU in Tempe and in shaping downtown Tempe is obviously huge, but also it was basically you and former Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon, right, who like shaped the future of downtown Phoenix a decade or so ago and put ASU down there and changed that place entirely. How do you view your role in growing the city, in revitalizing these places?
Education has always been foundational to the democracy. And so like that, but in a new and modern way, we've designed ASU to be what we call one university in many places.
Hmm.
We're now in every home, we're in every school, we're in every company. We're making certain that we are reaching you. The argument then is that our university is designed to be ubiquitously present, not to be behind a wall, not to be behind an ivory tower. So that's what we've done. We've taken down all the barriers and we've said, we're going to do the most advanced research in the world on how photosynthesis works using femtosecond speeds, billionths of a billionth of a billionth of a second, to understand the fundamental chemistry of how photosynthesis works. And we're going to help your sixth grade kid get through math.
Hmm. So you're saying it's not about the place, it's about being everywhere.
Yes, we call that one university in many places.
But what about the places? Because those have really changed because of ASU. I mean, especially if you look at downtown Phoenix, right?
So what happens is that people don't realize is that you can see this in London, you can see this in Paris, you can see this in Berlin and other big cities. Universities are historically, if they're in the downtown areas of big cities, they have a huge positive impact on things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that wasn't true here. It is true here now.
What do you make of the criticisms in that? I mean, like, you can't even imagine what downtown Phoenix would be like if ASU hadn't come there, right? But at the same time, there's concerns about gentrification, certainly affordable housing, yeah. Rent's gone way up.
Yeah.
What do you see as the university's responsibility to the greater community, to the city itself?
The way that one has to look at this is you have to listen to those things, be responsive to those things, be responsive to the community, engage the community, and then basically, you know, we're more like the tide. We're attempting to raise the tide. We're attempting to float all of the boats. And are there disruptions along the way? There are disruptions. All new technologies, all new institutions, all new things create disruptions. Our difference is that we are willing to accept that we're disruptive and then see what we can do about it.
How do you think you've been received by this community? Do you feel like it's the other way? Well, like we're talking a lot about your own impact on Phoenix. What's Phoenix's impact been on you?
Oh, it's been unbelievable. Living here has been like an unbelievable thing for me to live in an open-ended, non-socially, hierarchically controlled, preset place.
Hmm.
Most places are preset. There's more openness here than in other places that I've lived. I've lived in New York City. I've lived in Washington. I've lived in other places. This place is very open, very open-minded, very advanced. It's criticized by, I don't know what to call them other than just ignoramuses. But there's very few places that understand what that openness means. What that openness means is that there's a lot of voices here. And so what you get here is you get a lot of voices, a lot of ideas, a lot of openness to doing things in a new way. And all of that has impacted me powerfully. I don't believe that we could have birthed this new American university model anywhere but Arizona. And then it will definitively survive here and evolve here. And then others, I think, will emulate it from around the country and around the world.
So every time over the last several decades, a major university presidency opens up, your name is always in the mix. And
yep.
I think people worry or hope maybe that you will leave. Why have you never left?
You know, I don't really want to run something. You know, I could certainly run other universities or run other things. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in being a place where, like Arizona, where the democracy is still being designed, mm-hmm. the institutions are still being designed, and the team, myself and the others at ASU that have been a part of this, you know, we're a part of the birthing of a new kind of university. There's no lack of recognition of that. We are now seen as having built that.
Let me ask you about the future, which I think is a difficult question in Phoenix right now. Should a city this big be in the desert? That's like an actual question in the national debate right now. What do you make of that? What do you make of Phoenix's future?
What we need to do is to realize that we want this place to prosper and to be successful for the families that are located here and the businesses that are located here for the indefinite future. Mm-hmm. And the only way we can do that is to no longer think that this city should look like Minneapolis or it should look like Seattle. It should look like something that's never been built anywhere else before. It should have certain ways that it operates and certain ways that it does things that are truly unique. And we have a lot of those. Mm-hmm. And we need more of them. So what we need to become is a truly adaptive, one with nature kind of place. And we'll be fine if we do that.
Do you have faith we will?
Yes, completely. Totally.
Okay, last question for you then. Will you ever leave?
My wife and I, Sybil and I, we're not planning on going anywhere. You know, our plan is to keep working here till we can't do it anymore or move into a different kind of role, but stay here.
All right. ASU President Michael Crow, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
If you want to hear the rest of our Staying Power series, head to our website, theshow.kjzz.org. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Both ASU and U of A start their new football seasons on Saturday. The Sun Devils host Wyoming, while the Wildcats host New Mexico. It'll be, of course, the first season for both schools in the Big 12 after leaving the Pac-12. That'll mean games against some new opponents, but this isn't the first time the Arizona schools have moved conferences. Ryan Swanson is a professor at the University of New Mexico, where he focuses on sports history. And he's written a history of the Border Intercollegiate Athletic Conference, of which all three of Arizona's public universities were members starting in the 1930s. Swanson joins me to talk more about this. And Ryan, what was behind this group of schools trying to get together? It seems like there were maybe a few factors at play that led them to do this.
Yeah, I think there were a number of things going on. I think the first thing to consider is just the geography. The West, the Southwest, is a big place now. But really, in terms of technology and getting around and travel, it was even bigger, you know, almost 100 years ago. So when schools in Arizona and New Mexico and West Texas trying to figure out football schedules, you know, and football is really the key to all of this early on, you know, they're trying to find some proximity. And so I think the Border Conference is certainly just about figuring out that geography. Another part of it, though, is concern that the athletics that are going on, the intercollegiate athletics that are going on in this region of the country, are particularly prone to corruption. You know, you've got players jumping from one team to the next. You have no kind of set shared rules. And so, you know, while there's a part of the Southwest that really embraces the Wild West mentality, the thinking from some university leaders is it's kind of time to rein it in, get organized. And you know, there's a desire to do so with kind of like-minded, like-situate universities.
So the Border Conference lasts roughly 30 years or so before it really starts to break up. Mm-hmm. At the time in the early to mid 60s when schools were really leaving it, what was its reputation in college athletics?
Pretty solid. You know, it was a place that seemed to be growing too. Certainly the Border Conference benefited from its connection with bowl games. You know, the Sun Bowl, the development of games in Phoenix and Tucson. So those bowl games were seen as really innovative and promising. There was probably even some jealousy kind of from other conferences. So the Border Conference really has a really good 20-year run. And it's really most of that time kind of on an upward trajectory.
Yeah. So we've obviously seen so much realignment and, you know, conferences expanding and contracting in recent years. And one of the big reasons why, a lot of observers say, is money. I'm wondering what role money played for these schools and this conference back during its time.
Initially, money is really at the forefront of the Border Conference. I mean, one of the reasons they want to get organized is, as I've already said, kind of the respectability and let's figure out the rules. There's certainly that component. But another part of it is figuring out how to maximize revenues. And so, you know, the university, and I'll just call them by their modern names, University of Arizona, Arizona State, Northern Arizona, University of New Mexico, New Mexico State are the initial five to get together. And their desire is to create rivalries, which will drive people to the games, you know, increase the gate. They also want to sign new radio contracts that will bring more money in that way. So, at the beginning, there's really a concern about bringing in revenue. But what I will say, when the Border Conference breaks apart, I think it's less about money and more about reputation and kind of aligning with like-minded schools that breaks things apart.
So you also write about the roles of race and class in the Border Conference. And it's so interesting because it seems like in some ways, it's very similar to what a lot of schools were probably dealing with at the time. But in some ways, it feels very different.
Yeah, I mean, so the Southwest has a different climate in terms of race from the rest of the country in the 1940s, for example. If you think about college football, the hotbeds of college football have long been, for example, the American South, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a racial history and a history of slavery and a history of Jim Crow at that time in the 1940s, dealing with Jim Crow. That's all kind of going on in the American South. Real problems, real things to deal with. But I would argue an unfortunate clarity. You know, in the 1940s, there's no question if the University of Mississippi or Arkansas or, you know, something like that is going to allow African Americans to compete. They're not. Whereas in the Southwest, there's a bit of opportunity and ambiguity. And so race does become a tension point in the Border Conference, especially after World War II. And so in the Border Conference, it really becomes a divide between the Texas schools and everybody else. The Texas schools very much associate themselves with the customs of, you know, their brethren in the Lone Star State, and that causes problems in terms of what they are willing to consider interracial competition.
What role, if any, did all of that play in the Border Conference breaking up?
I think it plays a pretty pivotal one. Texas Tech comes late to the Border Conference. It joins a couple of years after the Arizona and New Mexico schools come in. And then El Paso comes in after that. But it's really Texas Tech that's kind of the troubling star of the conference for a long time. On the one hand, it puts more money into its sports and athletics and football. And so it has a lot of success. But Texas Tech is always looking to try to, you know, jettison the Border Conference and join the Texas schools. And similarly, it has a very rigid line on race. So what happens is there's a couple of incidences that force Texas Tech to kind of say exactly what its policy on race is in the athletic sphere. And for a long time, the school had just kind of tried to avoid the issue with other Border Conference schools. But in 1948, Texas Tech is slated to hold the conference track meet, the championship for the conference. And at that time, kind of leading up to that, the other schools from Arizona and New Mexico keep saying, what's your policy in terms of allowing our African-American athletes to compete? And finally, Texas Tech simply says, never mind, we won't host the meet. And they say they give it off to Albuquerque to kind of try to avoid it one last time. And so that eventually becomes a real schism between, you know, the Arizona schools and the New Mexico schools and Texas Tech.
I wonder if you see any through line from the Border Conference and sort of its rise and eventual fall to all of the conference realignment that we've been seeing over the past, let's say, half decade, you know, in modern times in college athletics.
Yeah, I'm sure there is a through line. I'm not sure I'm the one who can find it, but I'll take my best shot at it. You know, I think some of the consistencies you see when you look across college athletics over the past, you know, century, for example, is it's it's almost constant that universities are trying to reshuffle their associations in order to better themselves, right? And sometimes that's just about money. And that was true 100 years ago too, but the schools of the Border Conference were really kind of looking around and shifting their positions in a way that isn't that different than the Arizona schools here just did with the Pac-12 and now the Big 12. Trying to figure out what kind of university should we associate with? Where's our future best? Where are we going to be best for the future? And there's no guarantees. And so there's kind of this mix of loyalty, but longing for something different, but we know what's here, but maybe that's better over there. So I see that as kind of a through line, that there's just this never ending, looking over what is the grass greener on the other side. And I don't think, we've had a big reshuffling in college athletics now, but history would tell us there's no reason to suspect that universities are going to stop looking around for what's next.
All right. That is Ryan Swanson, a professor at the University of New Mexico. Ryan, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Mark will have your Friday news cap tomorrow and much more. Be sure to be there at 9 a.m. for that. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.